tonight's start tonight's talk, and the topic for tonight is going to be on the idea of progress, and because progress is one of those very important things that makes life meaningful. Yeah, we all want to have progress one way or another, and without progress life seems kind of empty and pointless. But of course, progress means a lot of different things to different people. Progress means often one thing in the worldly sense and something quite different in the spiritual teachings, including in Buddhism. But if you look at the world in general, it is, you know, we are obsessed with trying to make progress. It's always about kind of creating a better society, improving the way things are done, having maybe a fairer distribution of things, getting the economy to grow more, technological process, understanding the world around us better through science and all of these things. And so much is about kind of progress in a sense. And in a sense it's almost obsessive, precisely because that is the point of life. This is the purpose, the aim. You need to have something to look forward to. Otherwise, life doesn't really have any point anymore, almost. And yet, when I always remember when I was kind of in my teenage years, I started to think about the meaning of life and these kind of things. I don't know about you, but when I was a teenager, it was kind of big questions for me. It was, what is the purpose of life? What am I here for? I guess it's for many people, young people, is the same. Because you want to set up your life. You want to know what you want to do. And for that reason, understanding the meaning really matters when you are young. So I often obsessed about these things endlessly. And maybe that's why I became a Buddhist monk. But maybe that's the reason. Not sure. Maybe that's how I ended up with this. I'm not sure. But anyway. So what was so fascinating when I thought about the meaning of life was, of course, you look around you and you look at other people in the world and you try to understand, are people actually finding any real meaning in their life? Are they finding any real purpose? Have they, when they die, are they more content or happy than when they started out, when they were born? You know, have they actually got anywhere? And very often when I looked at people, I thought, actually, most people, when they die, that isn't that the difference between what they are when they die, pass away, and what they were during their life. It isn't that great. If you ask them how you found the meaning of life, they will shrug their shoulders and won't really know what to answer. And very often it seemed like this, you go through this process. You start out in life, you get born, you go through the same thing that everyone else does because of social expectations or whatever. You have a family, you get educated, you work really hard, and then you die. Yeah, and it's like, and then you wonder, why? What was the point of all of that? And this is what I kind of, when I looked at life, it looked so strange, it looked so, not even mysterious, it looked so plain, so ordinary, so pointless in many ways. And I realized that even though as a society sometimes we do actually make progress, I mean certainly over the past few centuries on this planet in terms of the things I mentioned before, technology or whatever it is, we certainly have made progress in that sense. Nobody could deny that. But yet on the personal level, when it came to ordinary people, did they make progress in their personal life? Had they really found anything meaningful when they passed away compared to when they came into this world? And the answer was very often, to me, it seemed like, not really. Hadn't really got anywhere, hadn't really found any answers. And that's why, whether you were old or young, sometimes you were equally ignorant or equally silly or equally lacking in understanding about the meaning of life. And this was a kind of an opening, this was an insight to me, because I realized that so often in this world, we look for progress in society. We look for progress in the big picture of things. We try to make a better world. And yet we forget about the individual. We forget about really, because the center of the universe is each one of us. Each one of us is the one that matters in this world. And if we don't have a sense of personal fulfillment or something happening, then the question is, have we really made any progress at all? I'm not suggesting, by the way, that there is no connection between the two. Of course, there is a little bit of connection if we do create a better society and everyone benefits a little bit. But in the end, it's a small amount. It doesn't really kind of amount to any kind of personal transformation, any kind of massive insight on the part of most people. So this was my starting point, realizing that what is a true progress in the world. Actually, we need to define that idea very clearly to understand what progress is all about. And of course, in Buddhism, the idea of progress in the spiritual path, the idea of progress is actually very different from how people normally define it. But in a sense, it's even worse than that, because in a sense that you can even ask whether those progresses that we've had in the world over the last few centuries, with the technological progress, the progress in making a better society and all of these things, even those, you start to wonder, how real are they really here? How substantial are they? How tangible are they? How durable are they? How long are they going to last? How strong are they? Are they going to withstand the winds of change in the world and all of these kind of things? And you start to realize that the more you look at the various things that we have improved over the centuries, especially if you take a Buddhist point of view, it actually is very uncertain, very unreliable. It is not a law of nature that we're always going to improve the economy or improve the technology or have a better society, even though it has happened so far for a long period of time. It is not a law of nature. It is very unreliable what's going to happen next. And especially now that we live in times of great turmoil in the world, with climate change and political things that are happening everywhere and things are so uncertain, you start to realize the uncertainty of all of this. There's nothing solid that underpins these things. There's just that somehow we have been able to organize our society in a certain way to make that progress. But actually, it is really, really uncertain where it's going to go from here. So when you start to see that, and this is a very Buddhist idea of the world. I gave a talk here a few weeks ago, and I said one of the differences between Buddhism or maybe some Asian philosophy and the kind of way we tend to look at things in the West is the idea of time is very different. In the Western background, a Christian background, we tend to have a linear idea of time. The idea that time starts in a certain place and then moves forward. And when you have a linear idea of time, there's a feeling of progress. There's a feeling that you have a beginning and there is an end inside somewhere. But the Buddhist idea of time is circular. And when things are circular, it means you always come back again. You come back to where you started out. You kind of go around, you build things up, and then somehow things then start to deteriorate at a certain point. And eventually you come back to the beginning point where you were a long, long time ago. And there are various kinds of these cycles. These cycles can take many different flavors, many different types. There is the idea of birth and death of an individual, the idea of rebirth. There's also ideas of much larger cycles in society or even in the universe. And all of these things are just cyclical things coming back to the beginning. And in that, the kind of idea of progress is challenged at a very, very profound level. Are we really going anywhere with society? Is it really heading anywhere? And you start to lose some of that feeling that actually there is any real point to this larger society, the world larger outside. And that challenges you. It's actually sometimes can be quite hard to bear, because it means that so much of the things that we value in life, the progress that we're thinking there, actually may be far less firmly based than we would actually like it to be. And that, of course, is very problematic. So this is the first thing, that you kind of come out of the Buddhist idea, Buddhist worldview, is that progress actually is not really anywhere near as solid as it may seem if you look on a purely historical point of view, what's happened over the last 10,000 years since the Stone Age or whatever in humanity. It is actually very, very not very solid at all, and far less uncertain what's going to happen in the future. And this is very interesting, because what it means is that you start to look at progress in a different way. And sometimes this can be very useful. One of the things that we have sometimes discussed is the Buddhist Society, obviously the Buddhist Society WA, because this is this organization we have here. This is why you're all here, because of this organization. And one of the things about the Buddhist Society is that it is an organization like any organization in society. And if you look at the Buddhist Society, it has now existed about 47 years. This was established in 1973 on Vaisak Day, so it's soon the 47th anniversary of the Buddha Society. And if you look at the Buddha society over those 47 years, it has in many ways been very successful. Yeah, it started out with a few people coming together and then gradually building it up. And now it is probably one of the most successful in many ways Buddhist societies, certainly in the Western world. And that's quite remarkable. Yeah, it's quite astonishing when you think about that. It is not obvious. Here we are in Perth, yeah, at the kind of end of the world. Is that right? That's what people say, the kind of the end of the world, far away from anything. That's why I came to Perth, by the way, because it was at the end of the world. I thought, end of the world is pretty cool. So let's go to the end of the world. Maybe we should rename the Buddha society as the... Actually, Ajahn Sujata, one of my monastic friends, he has a really nice name for his Buddhist monastery. It's called the Lokanta Vihara. It means the monastery at the end of the world. Maybe we should rename Buddha society here, something like that. But that's really, it's really nice to have Buddha society so far away. But it's not obvious that Perth should have one of the most successful Buddha societies anywhere in the Western world. You might think London or New York, yeah, or at a stretch maybe Sydney, but not Perth. But actually, in many ways, I think Perth is really, really suitable for having a Buddha society like this. There are many things about Perth that is really great and wonderful, like all the, you know, the relatively abundance of land, you can have monasteries and all these kind of things. It makes it very, very suitable for a Buddha society. But the point is, we have been very successful. That's really what I'm talking about here. Yeah, getting a bit sidetracked, but we have been very successful at a Buddha society here. And sometimes the idea is that we have to keep that success going here. But are we going to be able to keep that success going here? And the answer, of course, is no. We know it's going to stop one day. Yeah, one day it's going to kind of reach a peak. And when it reaches a peak, it's going to start to go down. Yeah. And if you look far enough into the future, guaranteed, the Buddha Society, WA, would no longer exist. Yeah, if you look maybe, we don't know how fast it's going to be. Is it going to be in 10 years? What happens if Ajahn Brahm dies? Well, this is kind of an interesting question. What happens if Ajahn Brahm dies? And one of the things I know, we have in our monastery, you think it's a very solid monastery, right? We have 25 monks in our monastery, really, really solid. And then you start asking the monks, well, what happens if Ajahn Brahm dies? And the monks say, yeah, I will be the first one to leave if Ajahn Brahm dies. And you start counting the number of monks who will be left, yeah, if Ajahn Brahm dies. And I haven't asked the nuns, but maybe they have the same problem. Yeah, maybe they start kind of gradually disappearing if that happens. What about everyone here? Are you going to come here on Friday night talk if Ajahn Brahm never shows up? You're probably going to say, oh, I miss those jokes, those good stories. Yeah, I have so much fun with Ajahn Brahm. What happened with Ajahn Brahm? This is what's going to happen. This is the reality. Because Ajahn Brahm is a very, very powerful personality with very powerful spiritual qualities. It's very hard to keep that up without someone to lead the Buddha society like that. I'm just giving you one example. And there are so many potential obstacles for the future prosperity of the Buddha society. Yeah? So when we think about the Buddha society in that way, we know that one day down the track it's going to start to disappear. It could already be at its peak. Who knows? Who knows what's going on? Yeah? And then we start to think about it in a different way. A lot of the time, when you look at how the committee of the Buddha Society works, yeah, a lot of the time the committee is a very nice committee. People are very sincere, they're very good-hearted, and they try their very best to do the best for the Buddha Society. But sometimes you get into arguments, yeah, and sometimes those arguments can get a little bit out of hand, even on the committee level. And when you try to analyze why that is the case, very often it's because of conflicting visions about the future. One person wants to do A, another person wants to do B, and they become very stubborn about it because this is important, it's about the future of the Buddha society. But when you remember that the future is bound to go downhill anyway, when you remember that the future of Buddha society really is, in the end, it is oblivion, that's what it is ultimately, then how important is it to get your way at that committee meeting? And then you start to change your attitude. Instead of trying to always make progress, the primary thing, even for the Buddha society, I'm not suggesting we shouldn't have progress. We should. But we should do it in a measured way, in a way that actually works, rather than doing it as an obsession, because we think that the Buddhist society will always be around and always be there to kind of to be a strong aspect of the Buddhist community in Perth. And then when you do that, when you think in that way, you start to deal with the committee meetings, you start to deal with your official position in the Buddhist society in a way that is different. Yeah, you become more flexible. You become more accepting of the opinions of others. You give up your own opinion more easily. And you just do your work. You do your work in a quiet way, behind the scenes. And those are the people I often am most impressed by. The people just work away quietly. Yeah, they know that they have a job to be done, and they do it without really getting into the ego thing, the arguments about the future, which is so uncertain anyway. Progress, maybe, maybe not. But certainly, we should make sure that we act according to the Buddhist teachings, with kindness, with care, supporting each other. That is really where it is at. And we have to be very careful with that. And the same thing with the monasteries. Yeah, even the monasteries sometimes they get kind of really obsessed about building new cuties or whatever. I want more cuties. I don't want any more cuties. We have enough cuties already. No, you are wrong. I'm right. Even in monasteries, these things happen. Yeah, when I met the just wise laughing, you know this happens sometimes. But quickly, wait, hold on, wait a minute. We're getting out of hand here. Yeah. So always coming back to what this path is really about, what the point of these things are, and then remembering that this progress in the world is an illusion. It's illusory progress. Progress that doesn't really go anywhere ultimately. Ultimately, it will fall apart. Ultimately, things will go wrong. Doesn't mean that we can't have temporary progress, but it means that in the long run, things are not going to work out. So you have to look for meaning somewhere else. Look for progress somewhere else. You can take this also into your family life, if you like, or your personal life. Yeah, progress as a person, what does it mean? Very often for people it means progress in terms of material well-being. It may mean progress at work. It may mean progress in maybe bringing up your children. Yeah, that's also uncertain. You don't know what your children are going to do. You want your children to get straight A's and to be superstar at sports. Yeah, cricket, is that right? Whatever it is. But it's not going to. But so often it doesn't happen. Often things kind of turn out so differently. We cannot, again, the idea of progress, even in our personal life, is just so uncertain. So we start to change. We change our attitude, and we look for progress in a very different place. Now, one of my favorite similes that I often talk about when I give Dhamma talks, because I just like the simile so much, and it kind of drives home the point about what is really going on here, and this is a simile of the borrowed goods. Yeah, and this is the Buddha. He says that he should think about the world outside of us. And when he says the world, he means really literally everything, all the things I've been talking about now, the world at large, our personal life, the Buddhist society, everything that is kind of within our ordinary sphere. Yeah, the world at large. We should think about that world, that entire world, as borrowed goods. Yeah, many of you have heard this simile before, but such a wonderful and beautiful simile. It's so evocative, in my opinion. And he says, it's just like, imagine a person, an ordinary person, they borrow something really fancy. Yeah, in the sutta, these are the ancient texts of Buddhism, it says that he borrows a carriage and earrings. Okay, it doesn't sound all that kind of interesting. Also, let's say he borrows a Ferrari and a large house. Yeah, that kind of makes more sense in the modern context. You borrow a Ferrari and a large house, and then you drive around on the freeway in your Ferrari. Yes. And then people say, wow, look at that Ferrari. Yeah, this is how the wealthy people in Perth enjoy themselves. They got Ferraris like that. And when you see his house, he got this big mansion of a house. Yeah, this is how the wealthy enjoy their wealth. And when you hear other people say that about you, this is literally what it says in the sutta. Yeah, then you kind of start to identify with that. Yeah, I am this wealthy person. This, yeah, because I have a Ferrari. I'm really, this is how you enjoy your life as a wealthy person. Start to identify with that. But you forget that it is borrowed goods. This Ferrari has been lent to you by somebody. The house has been lent to you. And as you identify with that, one day the people who lent it to you, they come and say, it's time to give it back. And how does that feel if you have identified with it? If now you think this is part of me, this is part of my personality, part of who I am, yeah? It's like anyone in this world, we identify with all these kind of things that make us into solid entities. When it's taken back and it's taken from you, you feel naked, yeah? Because you have identified with it, you have taken it as something you own, when in fact it is only something that you have borrowed. And you feel the sense of emptiness, a sense of meaningless, as these things that you identify with have to be given back to the owners. And the point of the Buddha is that everything in life is like that. Everything in life are like borrowed goods. Yeah, and you know it's true. Yeah, it is the sad reality of existence. In the end, you won't be able to take things with you. Either they will have to go in this very life as you live, or at the very latest, it's all going to have to go when you die. Yeah. And this is everything in the sensual realm, in the realm around us. It is our country of Australia. I can now say it's my country as well, because I'm now an Aussie citizen. Yeah, in case you didn't know, happened recently. So I'm not an Aussie. Should have a little Aussie flag here. But I've got that. Yeah, that all of that has to go. Everything you own in this life, so much of your identity that is kind of bound up with this world. Almost everything in your life has to go when eventually you pass away. Everything is borrowed goods. So if you think about your life like that, if you remember that almost everything in your life is borrowed in a certain sense, your attitude towards it starts to change. Yeah, because when you have something, if you imagine that you have borrowed a car or you have rented a car, and you compare your attitude to a rented car compared to a car that you actually own, what is the difference in feeling towards a rental car, towards a car that you own? It's a difference in feeling, isn't it? One car, if someone dents your car, runs into you, you get really, really angry. If someone runs into your dented car, okay, you get a bit upset, but it doesn't matter so much, yeah? This is kind of the difference. It doesn't mean that you don't look after the rented car. You do, because you are a good person. You know it is right to look after the property of others. But you don't care about it quite in the same way. And this is the way we go through life. We go through life in a way which is much more easy, much more light, not grasping so much, understanding that we are visitors, we come here for a while, and one day we're going to have to leave, and everything is going to have to be given back to nature. Nature always claims everything back again, and this is what you have to understand. And your attitude to the world changes because of that. You think about things in a new way, and this is what is so powerful about this particular simile. But there is an additional benefit to this. When you understand that everything in life is borrowed, everything is there for a short while, also the people in our lives, yeah, our family members, our friends, our acquaintances, Ajahn Brahm, everyone. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm, I guess, is a bit like my father now. After my own father died, I guess he has become kind of my father. So he's really hands-off father. That's what I like about Ajahn Brahm, really kind of hands-off. He likes you to, you can do whatever you want with Ajahn Brahm, which is that good or bad? I'm not sure. Anyway, all of this is uncertain. All of this is part of the borrowed goods. Yeah? All our human relationships. And that is one of the most difficult things to take. But there's also something very beautiful that comes out of that. Because when you remember the fragility of human life, how fragile we are, each one of us, how easily this body goes wrong, how easily it is to get a cancer, how easy it is to get some kind of heart problems or whatever it is. And if you look at these bodies, I don't know if you have studied any anatomy or anything like that, but these bodies are so ridiculously complex. Yeah, have you seen all the kind of the blood vessels, from the tiny, tiny blood vessels that go around? There's like a miracle that it even works, this body. Then you have the kind of the nerves going through it. That's why you can feel everything. Then you have the lymph system. Then you have all of these organs working together. Then you have this brain, this squishy little thing in here. Yeah, with kind of really all these neurons firing. I mean, it's just so super duper complex. I'm always surprised I'm still alive when I wake up in the morning, because this body is surely, it's not supposed to be alive with so much complexity. So We're so fragile as human beings, so extremely fragile. And when you remember the fragility of your own body, and also the fragility of people around you, not only physically fragile, but also mentally fragile very often, you start to think about people in a new way. You become a more caring person. So the idea of remembering the borrowedness of everything in life makes you more caring. Yeah. And there's a beautiful simile that Ajahn Brahm often tells, which is similar, it was told by Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand. For those of you who don't know, very, very famous monk. Probably the most famous meditation master in Thailand in the 20th century. He died in 1992, I think, yeah, something like that. And very famously, one day he was teaching the monks, and he takes a glass, and he holds up the glass, and he says to the big crowd, always big crowds when Ajahn Chah was teaching. Everyone wanted to see Lumpu Cha because he was this very powerful teacher. So he holds up this glass and he says to the crowd, and now I'm going to say the same to you, can you see the crack in that glass? No, you can't see it. Aha, okay, very interesting. Can anyone else see the crack in that glass? No, can't see it either. Okay, so that is not because you have bad eyesight, yeah? It's not because of that, but it's because you don't have the same wisdom as Ajahn Chah. That's why you can't see the crack. Yeah. So Ajahn Chah says, well, there may not be a crack in that glass, but we know that the glass is fragile. One day that glass, someone is going to drop it somewhere, not on a nice carpet like here, but on a concrete floor. And when that glass gets dropped on a concrete floor, it's going to shatter into 100 pieces, because that is the nature of a glass. So the crack is already there. It's already waiting to break up. Even though you can't see it, from a wisdom point of view, the crack is already embedded in that glass. And because we know that the glass is fragile, what do? We care for the glass. We hold it with two hands, yeah, and these kind of things. And we put it down gently, not harshly, on the saucer that is next to it. And that is how we ensure that we look after things in this world. And in the same way, if you are wise about the impermanence of things, if you remember the fragility of human life of each one of us, you become more caring. This is the beautiful thing, because you understand that things are so uncertain, so unreliable. Tomorrow could be the end. Tomorrow this body could break up, and it could be the end of things. And if you are wise about that, instead of crying or being depressed, you start caring for the world around you. And this is the beautiful thing about the wisdom of impermanence, the beautiful thing about the true wisdom on the path. Instead of making you despair, it makes you a better person as a consequence. That is the real value of insight, basic understanding on the Buddhist path. It makes you a better, more caring, more kind, and more compassionate person in this world, because you understand the nature of this life. And that is what this really is about. So, this is how this works. This is how this whole, how we gradually move away and we start moving in a different direction. Maybe to add to your understanding of what is going on a little bit, I want to show this from another aspect, another point of view. Yeah, this may be quite obvious what I'm talking about, but this can also be understood from the point of view of dependent origination. Dependent origination is one of these very interesting Buddhist teachings. It's a very powerful teaching that shows how suffering ultimately is caused by delusion or lack of understanding of the world. And in a sense, I've just shown that through the way I was talking now. If you are deluded, if you don't know how things work, you tend to suffer as a consequence. And I'm sure you can make sense of that. Yeah, it sort of makes sense. If you don't really know what is right and what is wrong and up and down, and you are blind to things, then very easy to suffer because of that. So, according to dependent origination, it's a sequence of 12 links. It starts off, the very first one of these links is precisely delusion. Yeah, delusion, illusion, ignorance, lack of understanding, not seeing things according to reality. You can call it all of these kind of things. So because we don't see things according to reality, because we think that there is progress to be made in the world, because we think that there are real results to be had in the world, because of that, what the problem there is that we are looking for happiness in the wrong place. Yeah, we think that happiness is actually found in one place, when happiness really is found somewhere else. We think that happiness is found somewhere, but actually it is suffering that is found in the place where we often look for happiness. Yeah, the Buddha often said, or he sometimes said, that where the Buddhas see happiness, ordinary people see suffering. Where ordinary people see happiness, the Buddha sees suffering. So it's pointing out the root delusion, the root illusion that we all, most people have before they reach some kind of insight. So because of that, because the idea is that we think that we know where happiness is in the world, when in fact we don't, yeah? We think happiness is over here, then we start to act. We start to try to create that happiness in the world. And this is like the second factor in the sequence of dependent origination. It's called the factor of activity, of creativity, of trying to make the world according to your own delusion. Trying to create that happiness in life because you think you know where it is. But you can see how problematic this is. Yeah? And this is why people do so much in life. Why, as a Buddhist society, we try to create a good Buddhist society for the future. Why governments try to create a better society and all of these kind of things. It's based on this idea that we think we know where happiness is to be found. This is why we do almost everything that we do in our life. Get into relationships, why we become Buddhist monks, yeah? Get into that kind of relationship, the Buddhist monk relationship, it's a different one. Or whatever else it is that we do in life, it is all based on this idea, the pursuit of happiness. But if we don't understand where happiness is, it's going to be very problematic. Yeah, and this is what this is all about. But as you start to wake up, as you start to understand that that happiness does not actually exist in that external world, that happiness is something which is inside of us. It is something that you need to find in a psychological space rather than in the physical space of the world. Then your activities, your pursuits, the kind of happiness that you try to create, it changes direction. You start to look for that happiness somewhere else. You come here to the Buddha Society, you cross your legs, you close your eyes, and you try to do nothing. Are you able to do nothing? Some of you are able to do nothing? Yeah, okay. He's trying very hard, but he's laughing, so maybe he's not always succeeding. But you try to do nothing, and you actually realize the weird thing is that when you try to do nothing, actually often you find more happiness than when we are always running around trying to do things. Yeah, it's kind of an inverse of the reality as we think it is. And this is what this is about. It is about this whole idea of, instead of looking for progress in the worldly realm, which is always going to be delusive, which is going to be an endless running around trying to create it, you will fail because you are deluded about where real happiness, real contentment, and the end of suffering actually is to be found. And then you change your ideas, and you calm down that willpower, calm down the creative activity, and you create some other kind of happiness instead. And suddenly, you're on a different track, and things start to come together. And that is the search for happiness within, instead of the happiness without. And that is what the Buddhist path is all about. Searching, looking for end of problems, looking for contentment, looking for satisfaction, looking for compassion, looking for love, looking for all of these qualities inside of us rather than pursuing them in the world outside. That is the difference. And that is when you are on the right track. And to see how the Buddha talks about this, one of the very interesting things that always really struck me about the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha says that there is only one thing in the world that matters. Everything should be measured according to one measure. Yeah, and what is that one thing? Is that coronavirus, Nicholas? No? No? Okay, good. Good. Ooh, okay, you can breathe out. Yeah. Apart from coronavirus, only one thing that matters. Yeah, right now coronavirus matters a lot to everyone, but there's one other thing that matters, maybe even more than the coronavirus. Actually, I might have it as well, so stay away from me. Don't come too close. I was recently in certain countries where coronavirus is more widespread than in Perth. So don't, please, stay away. So I'm usually nice, but these things are kind of beyond my control. So. But what the Buddha says, and this is what is so fascinating, he says that everything in life should be measured by this one measure. There's only one thing that really matters in life. And that is, are you improving in wholesome qualities inside, and are you declining in unwholesome qualities? That is the only thing that matters in life. Because if you are, then you are on this path of progress, which is the spiritual path of progress. It is an inner progress, moving towards good qualities and moving away from the bad ones. So everything in your life should be based on that kind of measure. So what do we mean by wholesome qualities? What do we mean by good qualities inside? And you know it already, yeah? Good qualities inside are the kindness of your heart. They are the tolerance and respect that you have for other people. It is the compassion that you have for the world. It is the wisdom that you carry with you. It is the peace that you are able to live with even when the world is in turmoil. All of these beautiful qualities, yeah? It is the mindfulness that we build up in meditation practice. It is the stillness that comes when meditation is really profound. It is a joy and happiness on the Buddhist path. So this is what it's really all about. The Buddha says this is the only thing that we need to look for. And at the same time, we should look for the decline of the bad qualities, the decline of ill will, the decline of harsh judgment of other people, the decline of cruelty and negativity, the decline of excessive desires in the world, and the decline of a confused and clouded mind. Getting clarity instead. That is what life is all about. And everything we do in life, whether we are on the committee of the Buddhist Society, whether you are the federal government of Western Australia, I'm not sure about the federal government. Maybe stressing a little bit, but whatever we do in life, yeah, if you were the Prime Minister of Australia, you would be thinking like that, right? So the question should always be that, how can I act in such a way that I increase the wholesome states inside of me? And as I increase the wholesome states inside of me, I'm also helping to increase the wholesome qualities in all the people around me at the same time. That is all that matters. Then we are on the right path. Then we are making progress that really makes a difference in the world, because the inner qualities that we have are things the world cannot take away from us. Everything else in the world is uncertain. Everything else in the world is borrowed goods. But your inner qualities, if you build them up, they will stay with you. And that is a massive, massive difference. That is what real progress means in Buddhism. So this is what we should be doing. So how do we do this? And come here to the Buddhist Society, yeah, that's a good start. But how we do this, of course, is living the spiritual life in the right way, being kind, being compassionate, being peaceful, doing all the right things, yeah, that we know already from the Buddhist teachings. But to make it very clear to you, I want to tell you one last story here. And this is a story that I have known about for a very, very long time. But it's only very recently that the power of this story really started to hit home. I started to understand what this story really is about and how powerful it is. And this is a story about Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is, as you may have guessed, one of my favorite monks. I think after the Buddha, he's my favorite monk. Yeah? Buddha number one, then Ajahn Brahm number two. It's pretty much like that. That's how I work it. So I put Ajahn Brahm really, really high. And sometimes when you are around Ajahn Brahm, you know, he takes himself so utterly unseriously. He doesn't, you know, he's just so, there's no ego there, there's no sense that he, you know, whatever. So sometimes you forget about the profundity of Ajahn Brahm. But sometimes it shines through. And this particular story, it really shone through for me. And I started to understand some of those really powerful and deep qualities that he has as a person. And this story, this goes back to 1991, which was before I came to Perth. And this was when we had the very big fire at the monastery, at Bodhinyana Monastery. It was a fire that actually eventually swept through the whole monastery. Yeah, and it was the hottest day on record in Perth, yeah, until then, since records began, it was 46 point something degrees, yeah. It was towards the end of January, so the summer had already been going on for about a couple of months. So it was tinder dry, it was not a raindrop or a cloud inside. We all know what summer is like here in Perth. We had a bit of rain the last few days, that's kind of unusual. And on top of that, the winds were strong, yeah. It was absolutely disastrous conditions for any bushfire if it were to come through. And sure enough, a bushfire gets started. And nobody knows exactly why, but it got started south of the monastery. And the wind was going from the south to the north. Yeah? So the bushfire coming closer and closer. So all the monks, they gather in the hall and they're kind of consulting with the fire brigade to decide what to do. Should we evacuate? Should we stay in the monastery? This is a really, really bad fire. And it was a kind of fire where the crowns of the trees explode, yeah? Because the eucalyptus trees have so much oil in them. So when they catch on fire, it's like bang, it's like a bomb going off. And it jumps from one tree to the next one. And Ajahn Brahm said he could see these trees exploding like that, one after the other, because of the massive heat and the intensity of that fire. Now the point to remember here is that at this point in Ajahn Brahm's life, this was in January 1991, he had just spent the previous 7 years doing hardly anything except building up that monastery. Ajahn Brahm is famous for his incredibly hard work, especially when he was thin. He worked even harder than he does now. Yeah, he had more energy for work. And he was really thin. You'll be surprised. Those of you who don't know him, actually Ajahn Brahm has been thin once upon a time. Really, like really, really thin. Yeah. And he worked incredibly, incredibly hard. Ajahn Brahm was the kind of person who would wake up in the morning, yeah, have breakfast. Actually, didn't even have breakfast in those days. Start working straight away, work all the way to the meal. And if he was lucky, he would get a nice meal. If not, in those days, meal wasn't as certain at Bodhinyana Monastery as it is now. And then work in the afternoon. And often carry on until the evening. Yeah, it'd be 7 p.m. or something. So he would often work 10-hour days, yeah, sometimes even longer, 7 days a week. There was no weekend at the monastery. One day just merged into the next one. And then 7 days a week, and then like that, 7 years going, basically without stop. He put his whole life into that monastery. That was everything he did, yeah. He gave the occasional talk, but really, in those days, it was Ajahn Jagaro who gave the talks. Ajahn Brahm was much more withdrawn. That was what his life was about. This was his life's work, the building up of Bodhinyana Monastery here. A lot of the building licenses had Ajahn Brahm's name on them. He was the actual builder. One of the great stories, actually, from that building period, and you have to promise not to tell anyone. Can you keep a secret? Please keep a secret. So this is really a good thing that was, I think, health and safety regulations were far less in those days than they are now, fortunately. But if those of you have been to Bodhinyana Monastery, we have a main hall. Yeah, the main hall of the monastery, it has a kind of a big roof, yeah, going up. And at the apex, at the very corner, at the very top of the roof, it is probably about between 8 and 10 meters up. It is very high, really, really high up. And eventually, all the bricks had been laid for this wall. There was no roof at this time. There was just the wall going straight up, wobbling this way and that way, especially in the wind. And there was a few bricks at the top that hadn't been laid. Yeah. So Ajahn Brahm, being Ajahn Brahm, he takes a bucket of bricks in one hand. He takes the mortar in the other hand. Yeah. And then he walks up this jagged edge, because there's a brick edge. He walks up this edge, yeah, on the wall, which is completely freestanding, leaning, waving in the wind, moving in the wind, going up to the top. He lays the bricks up there and then comes down again. I don't know about you, for me, it makes me slightly kind of, I get vertigo even thinking about that, because for me, it's kind of completely, utterly madness. And he walks up on that wall and comes down. And that is the kind of commitment he had to Bodhinyana Monastery. He was essentially putting his life on the line to finish that monastery. And now the fire is coming. Now they are talking about whether they're going to evacuate the monastery. Yeah. Then there comes the point when this fireman says to Ajahn Brahm, yeah, he's starting to panic a little because the fire is so bad. We have to evacuate. At that moment, Ajahn Brahm told me later on, at that moment, I knew the monastery was going to burn down. Yeah, it didn't actually burn down. But at that moment, he was so sure it was going to burn down because the fire was so bad. And many of these buildings were made of wood, yeah, wooden buildings. At that moment, I knew the monastery was going to burn down. So, and then I asked him, well, what happened then? Well, the moment I knew the monastery was going to burn down, I just let go of everything. And I said to myself, if tomorrow morning I'm prepared to come back and start from scratch, from the very beginning again. And I thought to myself, wow, How can you think like that? The moment everything burns down is the moment when everyone cries. That's when everyone is in despair. When everyone has no idea, you know, you feel really desperate. My life's work is going up into the flames. But that moment, he said, tomorrow morning, I will start again from scratch. And you may think sometimes that the real superpowers of monks are all kind of weird things like flying through the air and this kind of stuff. But to me, this is far more powerful. Yeah, if you think about your life, anything that you have done, anything you have striven towards over long, long periods of time, any kind of progress you've been making, any kind of result you try to create in your life, yeah, all of these things, how do you feel when it's all destroyed? It takes, you may be able to deal with it eventually, but straight away, it feels terrible. Yeah, it feels really, really bad. But here is a person who can let go like that. Straight away, everything burns down, start again the next day. So I asked Ajahn Brahm, how could you do that? Yeah, because I was curious, how exactly do you do this? Because it sounds superhuman, no ordinary human being can do this. That's my feeling anyway. I told you, stay away from me. So that's right. Yeah. How do you do it? And Ajahn Brahm said, the reason I could do it was because when I built that monastery here, I never did it for the result. I never did it to actually build a monastery. I never did it for the progress. I never did it with an aim to have a monastery there. The reason I built the monastery here was because I knew it was a good thing to do. I did it out of love, out of gratitude, because that kind of kindness, that kind of giving to the world is a good thing to do. So that is the whole difference. Yeah, the whole difference is just the attitude you have to what you're doing here. If you focus on the results, if you focus on the progress, if you focus on where you want to go, you're always going to be let down because the fire is always going to come. There's always going to be a metaphorical fire in your life somewhere going to tear things down and destroy things for you. But if instead you focus on the process, if you focus on the why you do this, you do it out of kindness, you do it because you know kindness itself is good. That is the real progress. That is the real process that matters. If you do it for that reason, you will never have any regrets. Why? Because you carry that kindness with you into the future. You know you have done the right thing. You have built up something very powerful and beautiful inside of you. And that is the only progress, the only result that really matters in our world. And that is what Ajahn Brahm had seen in a very profound way. And that is why one of the reasons why I respect Ajahn Brahm so highly, because he has these kind of qualities, these kind of, to me, exceptional and remarkable qualities. So there you are. That is just a little talk. I wasn't quite clear what to talk about tonight, but the idea of progress and the idea of understanding where to really look for progress in your life. And make sure you look in the right place. And if you look in the right place and you do it in the right place, you will never be let down. And you will gradually transform yourself from an ordinary person, eventually one day becoming more like Ajahn Brahm maybe. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so if you have any comments or questions or anything, this is your chance now. Thank you very much. Would anyone like to say anything? Everyone is stunned into silence. Okay. Very good. Okay, if you think of anything, let me know, and you can come back afterwards. I'll just have a look at these questions from outside. So these are actually outside of Australia. The first one is from Sweden. This is my Swedish, Nordic Swedish brothers from Gothenburg. Okay, that's really cool. So, question number one. If one attains arahat, does the consciousness cease to exist after death? So if you attain arahantship, does that mean that your consciousness ceases after death? And the answer to that question is very profound. Yeah, and this is why I don't really like to answer that kind of question directly, because if you answer these kind of questions directly, it leads to misunderstanding. Yeah. The Buddha was often asked these kind of questions in the suttas, and very often he would not answer, And the reason he would not answer, because the person who was asking was coming from the wrong point of view. And if you come from the wrong point of view, you cannot understand the answer properly. So don't, I would say, don't worry about that. It's not really relevant. It's a misunderstanding of Buddhism to even ask that question in the first place, usually for most people. The right way to think about Buddhism is not whether consciousness ceases or not after death, of the arahant. The right way to think about it is that dukkha, suffering, problems cease. That is the right way to think about it. In other words, when you are an arahant, and especially when the arahant passes away, the arahant is the enlightened being, the awakened being, the highest kind of saint in Buddhism. When they pass away, all suffering comes to an end, and the highest kind of happiness comes instead. That is the right way to think about it. If you have the highest happiness, does it matter if consciousness is there or not? If consciousness is not there, you still have the highest happiness. If consciousness is there, you also have the highest happiness. Either way, you have the highest happiness. So the question is kind of slightly misguided. It's focusing on the wrong thing. It's not focusing on that thing that really matters, and that is whether you have suffering or not. That is the real issue, and that is the thing I would recommend people to focus on. If you talk too much about whether consciousness focus diseases or not, a lot of people will misunderstand what that actually means. Question number 2 from Toronto. Hello, Toronto. That's not your name, that's your place. Yeah, okay. Anyway, hello, Toronto. Some monastics do not accept rebirth from life to life. Rather, they are almost agnostic about it. How can they be a Buddhist monastic with this view? I must admit that I sympathize a little bit with you on that one, because the idea of rebirth is so embedded in the Buddha's teachings. It's very hard to make any sense, head nor tails, of the Buddha's teachings without the idea of rebirth. It is so much part of all the various categories and dependent origination, the 5 khandhas and the 4 noble truths and everything, that without it, the whole thing just collapses like a house of cards, really. You pull out one card, bang, the whole thing just falls apart. So I would say, yes, a Buddhist monastic, especially after some time, if you know and understand the word of the Buddha, you should really have some idea of rebirth, in my opinion. And the main reason why you should have that is because the idea of being a Buddhist monk, the idea of being any Buddhist, is that you take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. What does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha? It means that you take the Buddha as your guide. Yeah, you take his teachings as a guide. The Buddha makes no bones about it. There is rebirth. It's very, very clear from the Buddha's teachings. So if you reject what the Buddha is saying, are you really taking refuge in the Buddha, or are you not? That is the question that kind of person needs to ask themselves in that kind of situation. So that is the first part of my answer. The other part is to say that if you are agnostic about it, agnostic is not so bad. Yeah, if you reject it outright, it is problematic. But if you are agnostic about rebirth, it is kind of acceptable. We all are agnostic to some extent. Most people don't know that there is rebirth. You may have faith in it, but ultimately, if people are really going to ask you, you will have to probably accept that you are agnostic to some extent. Yeah, so that is, I think, acceptable, at least initially. And then as you develop your mind, as you understand the teachings of the Buddha better, your confidence and faith in that rebirth hopefully will increase, and gradually you move in that direction here. Okay, the last one is a question from Empty Space. That's what it says here. It doesn't have anything, so question from Empty Space. Okay. Isn't the life of a Theravadan monk extremism? Not dealing with money and relying on donations for food. That's one thing that confuses me. How is that the middle way? Didn't the Buddha give up extremism? So is the life of a Theravadan monk extremism? I don't know. It doesn't feel all extreme to me. It feels pretty kind of natural. But one of the problems here is that, yes, it sometimes says in the sutta that the Buddha gave up the both extremes. But both extremes is, I am not sure if I really like that translation fully. It doesn't, the word in Pali is anta, and anta means like an end. Yeah. So what he gave up was two opposite ends. He gave up two opposites. And these days, I think I prefer to translate that he gave up not two extremes, he gave up the two opposites, yeah, and then found the middle way between the two opposites. So the point of this is that the two opposites are both involved with the world around us, the sensual world. Yeah, if you torture yourself is one opposite, then of course that torturing of the body is a lot of pain and problems, and it actually attaches you to the body because of all the pain and problems. Yeah, that's kind of why it doesn't work. And on the other hand, if you indulge the five senses, you indulge in the world around you, then of course also you are attaching to that world. You're getting happiness and joy from it. So the idea of the middle way is to find that middle way where you are neither torturing the body, nor are you indulging the body. And when you do that, what happens is that that world of the five senses, the world of the body, starts to fade away. And that is where the development of the mind can happen. And this is why this middle way is so powerful, because it allows the extraneous things of the world to fall away, especially the body, the five senses, and then it allows you to give full focus on the development of the mind instead. And that is the point of the middle way. And of course, that development of the mind is a development which is very joyful. Yeah, if you get it right, if you practice in the right way, it is a very happy, peaceful, fulfilling, contented path. And that is why that path actually works. And that is why it isn't really extreme at all. It is kind of, it's maybe extreme happiness, but nobody really thinks of extreme happiness as extremism. Yeah, that's a kind of an acceptable kind of extremism, the extreme happiness. So we go for the extreme happiness. That's kind of the Buddhist path. Paramang Sukhang Nibbanang. Nibbanang Paramang Sukhang. Nibbana, in other words, the extinguishment is the highest happiness, says the Buddha. Okay, is there any last comments or questions? So everyone is happy? Everyone okay? Yeah? Okay, good. Nice to see you all tonight. And so let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha together here.